Talk given Saturday, 26th February, 1972. It is very difficult, even for the serious-minded and devoted person, to appreciate in any deep measure one of the profoundest implications of living the holy life, the religious life. Superficially, of course, one can go through all sorts of procedures which are considered religious living. But religious living in the depths, in its reality, the supreme reality that man can ever realize, is something of which we can have no conceptions, no specific ideas. We here are quite serious. We are earnest. But I sometimes wonder whether we appreciate, even in sufficient measure, the fact that for oneself there is nothing whatsoever to be gained, solved, achieved, or attained in terms of the religious life. Nothing to be gained by the self. We subscribe to this easily enough intellectually, but that is very superficial. In our daily life, we live as unto the self, the narrow, circumscribed self. If we develop the ability to look into our own thought processes and our feelings as they arise from moment to moment, we will find that they are the complete evidence of this. I'm not saying this in order to depress or to criticize. This is how it is. And it is better if we can perceive this in its inner depth as it affects our effort, our attempt to live the religious life. There is nothing for me. Here now, or in a hereafter, a mythical hereafter. And I deliberately say a mythical hereafter because the hereafter is a thing of wishful thinking, of conditioned belief, and so on. Any one being who is a living pattern of the energies, the forces, the powers, call them what you like, which are universal and which operate universally all the time, consummates ultimately into non-being, which is universal, nondescript, unidentifiable. the self-consciousness which makes us feel and live in terms of I am I, a self isolated from the totality. This consciousness is an illusion. It is an abstraction. The I am I consciousness does not survive. It persists only because of memory from moment to moment, a memory which is implanted in the very cells of the body. When that pattern disintegrates, every psychical phenomenon which is specifically tied up with the existence of that pattern also disintegrates and goes for good. This is extremely hard. It's a shattering fact. It is because we find it extremely difficult to understand that fact that we cling to the ego. And because we cling to the ego, we are unable to appreciate to the full, or anywhere near to the full, that there is nothing for me whatsoever. In actual fact, what I am saying about living the religious life applies to the totality of life. We all imagine that there is something for me here, there, and everywhere. Honors, gain, fame, security, comfort, pleasure, the fulfillment of desire, and so forth and so forth. All these appearances come into life. And usually they disappear more easily than the way in which they have come. Be very careful about this. The individual being consummates into the one universal non-being. The one universal non-being throws up individual appearances, you and I. Does it actually throw up separate appearances? We may well ask that question because it is a very important question. The totality, which is the universal all, does not throw up of its own will and accord individual appearances. You and I, as individual appearances, as individual beings, are conscious of ourselves and other selves and the totality in terms of separateness. It is in our consciousness, in our awareness, that the separation, the isolation, the whole process of beginning, proceeding, ending, birth and death lies. In our awareness, because we are incapable as individuals of being aware in terms of totality, we are aware in terms of separateness. This is our fundamental state of unenlightenment, of delusion. And so we believe in the actual separate existence of the I, and wishfully we believe in the continuity of that I. Let us understand this very deeply and very clearly. Let us understand it not through the process of explanation by one person. Let us all try and become aware of the reality of it right now. This totality, which is the universe, as far as you and I, being what we are, can see and experience and be aware of, consists of particulars, limited, finite particulars. Not that the particulars are limited, finite, mortal. We don't know, actually. They appear so to us. We are enclosed in this state of unawakenedness, of unenlightenment. We are enclosed in it. We are not able to function otherwise, as we are. Now, we human beings on this planet, as far as I know anyway, are the only creatures who have the capacity of looking within. That is how we become aware of ourselves in terms of separate ego. You see? Because we can look within. We get the I sense, as it is put in the Sankhya philosophy, the ahankara, the I maker, is there at work. And this I maker, starting or entering into the process of trying to climb out of his darkness, thinks in terms of isolation only. He is unaware of the fullness of relationships between self and the so-called not-self. If and when one really sees, that is, not merely holds it as an intellectual thought, but is actually livingly aware of all the relationships which exist between what seems a separate being, oneself, and what seem separate beings, other selves and separate objects throughout the universe. If one actually becomes aware of that, then the isolative functioning of oneself is out. One is in the state of complete and total relationship with everything within the one totality. And then what has happened is that the one totality has come to full self-awareness
through the apparently individual particular. And this is the mystery, the magic, the marvel of the process. But in that coming to full self-awareness through each individual being, the individual being has gained nothing, achieved nothing, attained nothing. What has happened is that all obstruction within the individual being to the emergence of that transcendent consciousness has been removed. All the dirt is out. All the fog has been cleared out. And the light which shines is not your light or my light, but it is the light of the total, of divinity itself, of transcendence itself, untrammeled, as far as that human being is concerned. This is what has happened. If I put it in a sentence, I could put it like this. I, the separate being, the psychophysical organism, completely perish as far as my awareness of myself as a separate being is concerned, in order that the transcendent reality may triumph. So you see what it means. There is nothing for me. Now, if I really see that, I will completely cease to seek for myself. I will completely cease to grasp at anything. I will not obstruct the universal becoming process. Because the universal becoming process receives its light, the light of transcendence, only insofar as I, by virtue of being a human being, have the power to see that by removing the obstructions within myself, this object, the living person, becomes a focus through which that transcendent energy, power, light, love, wisdom, call it what you like, can radiate upon the world. Now, you know, this may sound very fine and lovely and exalted and all the rest of it. Don't get carried away by the words, for goodness sake. All the words are false, insofar as no words can contain totality, can be the living totality. They can only make a picture. And the picture, after all, is only a very limited suggestiveness. For example, here am I, the living being, as we say, Firoz Mehta here. There is a portrait of him. One looks at the portrait, and because one's sense of sight has been trained and one knows how to recognize portraits, one says that, oh, that's a portrait of Firoz Mehta. But that is not the living Firoz Mehta. And the contents of that portrait, some oil paint and a canvas and some wood which surrounds the portrait, consider those contents in relationship to the living person, bodily, psychically. You see, there is no comparison between the two. So, the words are like that portrait. That is all. The thought is like that portrait. The thought is of poor value. Sometimes, all too often, the thought is useless. It is an obstruction, because it comes out of a consciousness and a mind that is tainted. It's tainted with its delusions and illusions. It's tainted with its fears, its grasping, its ambitions, its lusts, its greed, and all the rest of it. So the thoughts are quite useless. They are deluders. Thought coming from outside to you may indicate something of value to you if you yourself are in that state of intense attention, which is like a purifying fire, and it is able to perform the alchemy of getting rid of all the dross which is associated with that thought, and realize the pure truth embodied or supposed to be embodied in that thought. So you see, this is another implication of living the religious life. One has to stand entirely and absolutely upon one's own feet. There is nothing that one can gain from another. The spirit cannot walk with the aid of crutches. Only the mortal body can do so. How and why is it that we are in this spiritually poverty-stricken condition? This psychically, psychologically, somewhat impotent state, incapable. Let us look at one or two of the factors involved in this. You know, we have been considering the elements during the last two meetings. And of course, the elements for us in modern times are the chemical elements, we know all that. The old meaning of the word elements, both in the East and in the West, was summed up in the words earth, water, fire or light, air, and some added ether, the elements. And you remember, I think I mentioned it last time, the particular value of using those terms is just this, that although in modern times, because we study chemistry and science and so forth, we are aware of the chemical elements and all the rest of it, intellectually, we are not conscious of them as the individual elements. We are actually conscious only in terms of solids, liquids, gases, earth, water, air, temperatures, heat. Well, that has remained constant, more or less. See, that's how we are actually conscious, and we behave accordingly. So, for us, it is useful to consider these elements as just earth, water, and so on. The body is made up of just these elements. We start our existence in this world in terms of body consciousness fundamentally. And on the whole, if we are quite honest with ourselves, we remain body conscious right through our lives. Mainly body conscious. Not partially. The body is everything to us. Consider all our physical reactions when anything unpleasant or dangerous is presented to us, or when we are ill, when we are in pain physically. We are immediately concerned with getting rid of this which I don't like, which is unpleasant, or which is rather frightening, and all the rest of it. Aren't we? So you see how we cling to the elements. Why do we cling to the elements? Because contrary to all that we may say with our superficial conscious minds, we actually accept the fact and live by the fact that the body, the elements, is this wonderful thing, me. Actually, it's a perishing thing. We as bodies are perishers. But we don't see that. As and when we do really see that, then we completely cease to grasp at the body. Or want to preserve it unnecessarily. Our approach to the body and our attitude to the body becomes altogether different. We see it exactly for what it is. Something which is continuously undergoing change, transformation. But the transformation, because of our ignorance, is towards a meaningless, unintelligent death. A mere going to the grave. But if we are awake, it is a transformation process which we can see and realize as a process of perfecting and consummating as far as our awareness of reality is concerned. And then we will realize that this perishing thing, the body, is in fact something altogether indispensable for transcendent realization to take place. There is no transcendent realization through me when this body is dead, finished. That's the end of it. The material, what we commonly call the material of the body, has gone back to the universal storehouse of matter. What we are pleased to call in separative terms the mind is once more the original universal characterless energy, which we may call pure mind or mind only. There is no manifestation for mind only, accepting through the limitation, the making finite, which brings an individual human being into existence. So now, look at the body. The body is a very good example, simply because all the elements are there together. Earth, water, air, everything is there together in the living body. We have already touched upon our clinging to it, our delusion regarding it, that this is me. Now, I've just been saying it is a delusion. It is also not a delusion. The word me as an objective fact, limited and separate, is of course this body. It's not that body or that body or a dog's body or or a cow's carcass or anything like that. It isn't that at all. It's just precisely this, Firoz Mehta, and nothing else. This is me. Where then comes the delusion? In associating the idea of permanent entity, some mysterious permanent entity, in connection with the body. It is because of this delusion that the doctrine of resurrection, for example, has been so hopelessly misunderstood. And wrongly presented. People have talked of the resurrection of the body, despite St. Paul's straightforward statement that it is the spiritual which is resurrected, which rises up. And there is no such thing as a spiritual body, although some of the great ones themselves have fallen into the trap of using those words. So now all these elements are in here. And because the body is what it is, with its brain and nervous system, its existence, its continued existence through whatever span of life it has, is dependent upon the efficient functioning of the pleasure-pain mechanism of that nervous system. It's dependent upon that. Now, this pleasure-pain mechanism has its correspondent psychically in terms of joy, sorrow. But whereas with the pure physical mechanism of pleasure pain, the nervous mechanism, nothing else can be tied around it, added to it. Where the psychical joy, sorrow is concerned, a whole heap of imaginative thinking and feeling and desiring all gets tied up with the particular joy and the particular sorrow, which is the psychical counterpart of the physical pleasure pain. And this is where the whole of the psyche gets muddled up. It's an awful rag bag. There's no question of finding fault with anybody. Our parents, our friends, everybody around us conditions us. All the books that we read, the stories that we tell, the stories that we invent, we are urged to use our imaginative faculty. And how do we use our imaginative faculty? This is the question. Purely or impurely? As a creative power or as something which confines us, deludes us and binds us and therefore hurts us? And insofar as we are hurt and distorted, what goes out of us into the psychical atmosphere of the world is of the nature of greed and cruelty and hate and violence and so on. You see, all this springs from the body. It's rooted in the pleasure-pain mechanism of the body. Now, the religions of the world, in their orthodox formulation, have misformulated the art of releasing ourselves. They have all talked in terms of fighting the good fight, of getting rid of evil states, of cultivating virtues and good states, and so forth. I am confused, passionate, violent, ambitious, envious, and all the rest of it, as I am. Is it possible for me to conceive virtue? Won't I inevitably misconceive it? So if I strive for the conceived virtue, I, a deluded, incapable being, am striving for an illusory, inefficient virtue. I cannot conceive it truly. What then does one do? How does one live the religious life, if that is the case? See, all the past religions of the world have, at least the conventional orthodox presentation in the scriptures, is in terms of this conflict between virtue and vice. They have fixated the idea of virtue, the idea of vice. They have pictures of what is virtuous action and what is vicious action, and they are in conflict. All conflict breeds more conflict and usually worse conflict. So obviously, that way salvation does not lie. Salvation is a making whole, a healing. But consider, has any one of us the ability to heal, leave alone the knowledge? You and I can't heal. Healing takes place on its own. It's a mystery. This power, this process is something completely beyond petty little me. If I see that such and such are the mistakes I'm making, and I just become quiet and cease to make those mistakes, the healing process takes place. The whole-making process takes place. When I shut up
God speaks. When I am quiet, transcendence works its magic. This is the point. But you see, why don't I shut up? Why don't I keep quiet? Because basically, I cling to the elements as embodied in this physical constitution which bears my name. That is why. You know, the cells which compose our bodies, I have mentioned this a few times before, so please bear with me. The cells which make up our bodies have some wonderful powers. They are self-reproductive, self-motivated, self-healing. Physiology has revealed that to us in a marvelous way. How the cells are self-healing. If they are not hurt beyond repair, smashed up, or something like that, the cell will heal itself. I can only assist it to heal itself by refraining from interfering with its life process, or if I have discovered some ways and means by which I can help that life process, all right, I can do that and help the life process. But I don't do the healing, although I may do some helping. The healing is the prerogative of the eternal, the absolute, the void, that which is non-moving, non-active, according to my conceptions of movement and activity. You see, the living of the religious life is the complete reversal of the human condition and the human process. It's a complete reversal. It is not a negation, it is not an affirmation of the process as it is not a contradiction. It is a reversal of it, but a reversal so extraordinary that it brings about the integration of the whole, of all the parts to make up the whole, and subsumes them into its own profounder, transcendent reality. This is quite extraordinary. This is the marvel, the... I don't know what words to use. The mystery which is God or the Absolute or pure mind, or call it what you like. So now, supposing we start ceasing to cling to the elements. Objects, property, instruments of pleasure, etc., 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 instruments of everyday use, professional activity and so forth. Yes, use it. Use it with reverence. Use it with skill, with understanding, with love, but unpossessively. Because if there is clinging, there is taint. And one of the most important aspects of this release from clinging, grasping, greed, lust, all this is involved in it. One of the most important aspects is in relation to something which the whole human race does every day of its life. It eats and it drinks. See what we do with eating and drinking. Look into it very deeply. Don't look at it superficially.
You might say, come, you're not suggesting now that we've all got to eat one blade of grass per day and lick the dew in the morning from the grass? Of course not. Eat an ox, a whole ox at a time, if that is the right thing. The Buddha used to say, do what you think fit to do. But you have to have the capacity to see what is the fit thing, and the still subtler and more wonderful capacity to do it naturally, harmoniously, without any conflict involved in it, without any lurking reservation inside oneself. Yes, I'm doing this, but I wish I could do the other. One might say, aren't you making mountains out of molehills? I think I said this last time, didn't I? But do remember that if you get a sufficiently large number of molehills, they make the mountain. This is the point. It adds up. It's a cumulative effect. And you know, this is one of the remarkable things which has been, I believe, I'm not quite certain of this, but I think it has been discovered in modern times, that when a cumulative effect has gone on and on and reached a certain critical point, it no longer remains an additive process, simply increasing the degree of the thing, but there is a change and there is a transformation of the whole thing, so that there is a difference in kind, not only in degree, produced. And this is most extraordinary. In the physical universe, we do know now scientifically that the processes which go on the atomic scale, within the atom, on the micro scale, and all the laws that apply to those processes are different from the laws which apply on the macro scale. Our very comfortable laws of nature, the immutable laws which are never broken and all the rest of it, they don't apply in that micro scale. Modern physics is something which should remain esoteric, hidden from the multitude. It should be studied by a person who has inward stability and poise to a remarkable degree, because it's mentally shattering to learn what modern physics puts out. Or, of course, one just has to be a blockhead, insensitive. Then one is all right. One won't be upset by it. So now, these effects work upon us. Ordinary eating, drinking. And those are only two things, mind you, very important things, actually, for our life. Those are only two aspects of what emerges out of clinging to the elements and the wrong approach, the wrong attitude to the elements. Food is solid, earth. Food is earth. Drink is water. Beer is a little bit of water and air, isn't it? Anything that froths up. And so forth. But the thing is this.
we have to learn to be very sensitive to it all. Which means to be awake, alert, watchful. Not watchful in the sense of being on guard against this, that or the other. Because that implies prejudice to start with, and that's no use, you're in the state of conflict. But with the mind completely open, totally open, putting aside all previous knowledge and experience, remain attentive, watchful. And that way we learn. We learn in the real sense. That is, in the religious sense. And this learning is the liberation of our own awareness of existence. The liberation from the confined, deluded state which throws up illusions, which brings into being all the terrible things that we think, feel, say and do throughout our daily life. The liberation out of that into a state of peace, of harmony, of inward purity which remains unshaken, which can never be sullied, of poise. And above all, of complete unselfness. This is living the holy life, the religious life. And this is the life that is the natural condition for a human being. The world lives subhumanly, bestially. This is human living. Why do I say this is human living? Because this is the potentiality which is embodied in us. To give the theistic name to this potentiality, it is God. Man who was able and is able to have the vision which he names God is giving a name to that which he himself is in innermost transcendent reality.